In a very, very loose way, something that, in fact, is not quite what we have named it as. We've called the whole thing the Aryan Nations. In fact, the Aryan Nations is, in reality, a fairly specific group or umbrella of groups, but we are using that term to refer to the entire generic boatload of various groups, including even larger real groups like the KKK and the John Birch Society, who have found themselves in many ways linked, sometimes merely by circumstance, but oftentimes by, in fact, overlapping memberships and unity of purpose in the world of covert politics since World War II. And we have traced the origin of a lot of these groups directly back into the military forces of this country. Specifically, a large chunk of the John Birch Society and other right-wing groups came directly out of the staff of General Douglas MacArthur. MacArthur himself, a man of somewhat profoundly right-wing beliefs, but more importantly, a symbol of the right in this country, a man who was suggested as being the military dictator in case of a fascist coup in this country, and a man whose staff, many members of which were actively involved in plotting various types of right-wing coups and overthrows of established elected power in this country. So we looked at that to begin with as a source for these types of right-wing fringe groups in order to make the point, which we will continue and elaborate on tonight, that what we are not talking about here is the sort of garden variety PR image of the Nazis in America and the KKK as being basically a bunch of seedy people who hold petty jobs places and disaffected and having no clout and not sensible enough to see what's really going on in the world and just kind of fulminating in solitude by themselves, except occasionally coming together to form these small little bands. In fact, we're talking about fairly large, fairly sophisticated, well-funded groups of people, many of them with ties directly into our military and intelligence establishment, much as was the case with the Freikorps in Germany before World War II.
Yeah, now, again, the popular conception of the Aryan Nations, and using that in a specific term, now the neo-Nazi umbrella organization that's coming to light in this trial in the Northwest, the popular conception has been, as Nip indicated, that this is a bunch of disaffected rednecks out on a Saturday night to raise hell. In point of fact, what we've been looking at is this group as part of a much larger paramilitary milieu, which is analogous to and in many ways linked to formative elements of the Freikorps in Germany. Now, recall the Freikorps were basically an underground extension of the German military put together for the purpose of initially putting down the German Revolution, and then they went on to systematically assassinate all of the legitimate democratic leaders of the Weimar Republic. In so doing, they paved the way for Nazism, and as we've looked at, the geniture of the Nazi Party itself was within this underground extension of the military. Now, recalling briefly to tie the Aryan Nations in a hard way with what we've been talking about, we began by looking in our first program at two military coups, both unsuccessful. The first, we looked at an attempted overthrow of the government by the military, and specifically we looked at how the Morgan and DuPont industrial groups basically were behind this particular coup, and we also looked at how they supported fascism in Germany. And then we took a look at the Morgan group's choice of, first of all, Douglas MacArthur as the man to lead this coup, although he did not lead it. And the man they chose to lead it eventually betrayed it. That's why it was unsuccessful, a man named Smedley Butler. Their second choice, the Morgan group's second choice, was a man named Hanford McNider, also a member of the MacArthur group. We then looked at a second coup attempt in which a MacArthur staffer named Van Horn Moseley was cooperating with not only German intelligence but also domestic fascists, including a man named William Dudley Pelley. Now, this 1939 coup attempt was unsuccessful. We then looked at that same Van Horn Moseley and that same William Dudley Pelley supporting MacArthur for president in 1944. One of the people who also supported MacArthur at that point was Gerald L.K. Smith, a domestic fascist. One of his top aides was a man named Wesley Swift. We then looked at how Wesley Swift, as an aide for Gerald L.K. Smith, nominated Douglas MacArthur for president for the Constitution Party and I've forgotten the name off the top of my head of Dudley's party. It's the same kind of a name. At any rate, Dudley Pelley's splinter political party nominated Douglas MacArthur to be president. Wesley Swift was the man who did it. Now, the Aryan Nations, specifically, we looked at the Posse Comitatus, founded by a member of William Dudley Pelley's Silvershirts. That's why we're tracing these roots. We then looked at what Colonel William Potter Gale, a MacArthur staffer, a man who fought in the Philippines, he was part of Swift's organization, as we're going to look at tonight. And in addition, another fellow who was a part of Wesley Swift and Gerald L.K. Smith's organizations was a man named Richard Butler, and which Richard Butler is the titular head of the Aryan Nations today. That's why we've been tracing all of these possibly obscure-seeming names to people like L.K. Smith, like William Dudley Pelley, and so forth. We've been tracing, if you go back to the geniture of the far-right groups today, they go back to the Dudley Pelleys, the Gerald L.K. Smiths, and the MacArthur staff and elements thereof are primary in this whole situation. Now, in 1944, we also looked at how Albert Wiedemeyer, a man with more fascist connections than the switchboard at Berchtesgaden, basically was, along with his father-in-law, General Embick, working to get troops switched from the European theater to the Pacific to get Douglas MacArthur home early. We then looked at how the entire China lobby and the John Birch Society grew out of the I guess you could call it an extension of the MacArthur group, because Wiedemeyer was part of that group, and we looked at how the China lobby grew up alongside and as part of the MacArthur organization.
Now, one of the key things too to look at here is when we talked about the beginnings of the John Birch Society was the fact that John Birch himself, who at some times is called a martyr to communism, at other times is called basically a nobody by a lot of other people wishing to poo-poo the right wing in this country, and the John Birch Society in particular, and admittedly a lot of their viewpoints makes it easy to do that or to want to do that, but as we saw, John Birch himself was an OSS agent involved in clandestine contact with, among other things, not only the Kuomintang of Chiang Kai-shek, but also, in fact, with the fascist Japanese army, which had nominally surrendered, but were in fact becoming, without having had their weapons taken away, enforcers for Chiang Kai-shek against the very communists and the peasants that they had just finished slaughtering and killing for about 4 years prior to World War II and right on through the war itself. So we also found out that John Birch's connections as an intelligence operative were run directly through the office of General Wiedemeyer, who had taken over for General Joseph Stilwell, because Stilwell had too many problems dealing with Chiang Kai-shek, whom Stilwell considered to be basically no better than Mussolini and Hitler, just not as well organized, which are more or less his exact words. So anyway, Wiedemeyer was brought in, and Wiedemeyer found it much easier to deal with Chiang Kai-shek, although even he could not prop up the eventual total fall of the Chiang Kai-shek regime in China. But during that time, all intelligence operations were run directly through Wiedemeyer's office, John Birch's intelligence operations being one of them, and of course John Birch was eventually killed in a scuffle with some communist Chinese that his own soldiers said that he probably provoked, and became the martyr of the John Birch Society movement. Wiedemeyer, of course, not only with his earlier fascist connections, but his later membership and in certain types of groups of a decidedly anti-democratic right-wing slant, and also his advisory capacity with the John Birch Society, and then, of course, reappearing in 1980 as a rather venerable old right-winger to work as a military advisor for the Reagan administration.
Now, we looked at how the MacArthur Group and the China Lobby, Wiedemeyer and General Edwin Walker, who was also a military advisor to the Nationalist Chinese, how they coalesced along with people like H.L. Hunt in the John Birch Society. And we compared the John Birch Society with the NSDAP, the German Nazi Party, and asked sort of rhetorically, is this the vehicle for introducing the army into civilian society? After looking at two unsuccessful coups in our first two programs, we then looked at what we feel to be, and it's certainly not our original thesis by any means, a successful coup on November 22, 1963, with the assassination of President Kennedy. And we looked at how the John Birch Society, with its two main subgroups, the MacArthur staff alumni, I guess you could say, and the China Lobby alumni, cooperated with other elements of JBS and with the intelligence community and the military to overthrow the United States government. And this basically represented the resolution of a constitutional struggle between the military and the legitimate democratic authority, democratic with a small d. Now, what we're going to be doing on the broadcast this evening is tying the Aryan Nations proper, meaning the people like Richard Butler, Keith Gilbert, William Gale, and the people who are spoken of with referred to specifically by the news media as the Aryan Nations, and we're going to tie that back in with this whole paramilitary milieu, such as the John Birch Society, the Ku Klux Klan, and so forth, and we're going to show you how they participated in the successful military coup of November 22, 1963, as well as the subsequent assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy. We'll also be looking at John Birch elements and how they intersect with all of this, and sort of showing how all of this comes up to the present day. But again, we're going to go back to our third and successful coup attempt in 1963 and see how this alleged group of rednecks figures into this whole situation and show that far from being a group of disaffected rednecks, these people are actually an organ of official U.S. policy, unfortunately for us. So that's basically what we're going to be doing tonight, is we're going to bring that in. We're also going to be updating a lot of the material from our first Guns of November broadcast, the background of the Kennedy assassination, and we're going to be talking a lot about Cuba, okay, and some roots of things which are growing and bearing acorns today.
Before Dave starts to read the first segment tonight, I'm going to have him remind you, because he remembers the date, and I think I would be incorrect with the date, but I'm going to have him remind you of the last article that we read last month when we finished Radio Free America about a certain United States ambassador in a very odd situation at a very odd time.
Well, basically, what we're talking about is a man named Henry Cabot Lodge. Henry Cabot Lodge was John F. Kennedy's ambassador to what then was the Republic of South Vietnam. And as we looked at in Guns of November number 3 about the connections between the Kennedy assassination and the Vietnam War, we looked at how Kennedy's Vietnam policy was sharply reversed by his assassination. Contrary to popular belief, which holds that there was no great difference in Vietnam policy between the Kennedy and Johnson administrations, there was. Kennedy had come to the conclusion that Vietnam was a dead end and was, as we saw in our Guns of November broadcast, in the process of pulling us out of Vietnam. And again, if that seems a little glib or facile to somebody, the relevant documentation, and in this case it's extremely weighty, is contained in our Guns of November number 3, and that again is available from DAVCorp. Okay, now, the reversal of Vietnam policy took place, of course, on, pursuant to the assassination on November 22nd, 1963. On the evening of the 24th, the evening of the day on which Ruby silenced Oswald, we saw that a meeting was held and Kennedy's Vietnam policy was turned around 180 degrees. 2 days before, the day before Kennedy was killed, Ambassador Henry Cabot Lodge was seen following the conference at which an accelerated withdrawal plan was agreed upon. This was in Honolulu on November 20th, the day before. We saw that Henry Cabot Lodge was seen pumping a whole stack of quarters into a payphone in the lobby of a hotel in Honolulu. Now, this is not only one of the top national security officials, or one of the most important national security officials in the country at the time. He was the ambassador to a key ally at that time, which was involved in a war. This is a man who could have had access to any sort of phone. Certainly, secure communications are something one would expect from a man like that. And as a member of the Cabot family, he was, of course, extremely well-heeled and not in need of pumping quarters into a payphone. In and of itself, it's certainly not conclusive, but it's an interesting place for him to be, an interesting thing for him to be doing at that particular time, in as much as he was our ambassador to Vietnam, and in as much as the policy agreed to the day before was about to be reversed by assassination. Now, we're going to be picking up again, right where we left off. We're going to be picking up with the successful coup on November 22nd, 1963, and we're going to be taking a look at a person we looked at some length in Guns of November number 3, and who we're going to be looking at tonight, namely Richard Milhouse Nixon. And, of course, recall, in Guns of November number 3, we found that Nixon was in Dallas, Texas on November 22nd, 1963, flew out right about the time of the assassination, and then when interviewed about that, 3 months later by the FBI, he was off by a full 48 hours in his recollections. He told the FBI that he left on November 20th. So, whereas most people are able to remember precisely where they were on the day at the time that Kennedy was killed, Richard Nixon, who defeated Kennedy in the 1960 election, and who just happened by coincidence to be in, or alleged coincidence, to be in Dallas, Texas on November 22nd, 1963, was totally unable to recall that 2 months later. Ask yourself how credible that is. Now, we're going to take a look here at some material which may suggest who Henry Cabot Lodge was calling when he was pumping those quarters into the payphone. Now, one thing that people who were alive at the time will remember, and those of you who, and God knows there are many people that have been born since, might not remember, is that Henry Cabot Lodge was Richard Nixon's vice presidential candidate in 1960 when Nixon was defeated by John Kennedy. Okay? It's also worth noting that the Cabot family was very much involved with United Fruit, and the Paines, who put the Oswalds up in the Dallas area, were very much involved, I think, cousins of the Paines and very much involved, or of the Cabots, rather, and very much involved with them. A possible explanation for not only what Richard Nixon was doing in Dallas, Texas on November 22nd, 1963, but what or who Henry Cabot Lodge, his former vice presidential candidate, may have been calling on November 21st, was carried in a book called Forgive My Grief, Volume 3. Forgive My Grief, Volumes 1 through 4, was put together by one of the top researchers on the Kennedy assassination. That's a fellow named Penn Jones, Jr. Penn is the editor, or was the editor, of the Midlothian Mirror. The Midlothian is a suburb of Dallas. Talking about corporations too much here. It's a suburb of Dallas, and Jones has been the editor of the paper there for many, many years, and as a result of his proximity to Dallas and his presence there at the time of the assassination, Penn Jones has become became very interested in the assassination and became one of the top researchers. By the way, there's an excellent biography of Penn Jones called Citizen's Arrest by a man named Nash. If you'd like to read the story of Penn's struggles in attempting to unearth the facts about the Kennedy assassination. Now, Forgive My Grief, Volume 3, the volume that we're about to deal with now, was copyrighted in 1969 and was privately published. Well, it was published by the Midlothian Mirror, Incorporated. Okay? So, 1969, Midlothian Mirror, Incorporated, is the copyright for Penn Jones, Forgive My Grief, Volume 3. And in an article, by the way, much of the material from the Forgive My Grief volumes comes from a series of editorials and articles in the Midlothian Mirror. And this particular excerpt here, and it's an editorial, was called The Head Man Was in Dallas. And Penn writes as follows in Forgive My Grief, Volume 3. Oh, by the way, the Murkison reported here is a man named Clint Murkison, Jr., Clint Murkison, Jr. Clint Murkison, Jr. is not only the former owner of the Dallas Cowboys, but also a prominent Texas oil man and an intimate of the Hunts and the people who we looked at in Guns of November, or Radio Free America, number 11, our last show about the Aryan Nations. And again, in Penn Jones' editorial here, from Forgive My Grief, Volume 3, entitled The Head Man Was in Dallas, talking about a party that was held by the aforementioned Clint Murkison, Jr. An earlier, unreported Murkison party was much more important than those of recent years. This party was held on the night of November 21st, 1963, at the Murkison home, and we think was the cover for an important conference of the assassination staff. We have always felt sure that before the president was killed, a staff conference was held somewhere, and all the elements of the assassination plot were present or represented. For a time, we thought the conference was held in Sykes, Louisiana. There were some planning meetings held in Sykes for some of the lower-level operatives, but not the big meeting just before the hit. When it is realized that the assassination of President Kennedy was even more important than the Normandy invasion with General Eisenhower in command, then the conference for the Dallas Project becomes essential. The killing of President Kennedy was the most important takeover of a country in our world history. All the major forces in this country were involved and had to be accounted for at the final conference before the strike. So a conference was necessary, and the conference was held. Since Richard M. Nixon and J. Edgar Hoover were in the Murkison home that night, this is November 21st, 1963, the night before the assassination, the same day on which Henry Cabot Lodge was pumping quarters into a payphone in Honolulu, resuming with Penn's narrative, so a conference was necessary and the conference was held. Since Richard M. Nixon and J. Edgar Hoover were in the Murkison home that night, we feel we should report that the conference was held there in the home, not in the presence of the partygoers, to be sure, but on the premises. J. Edgar Hoover, the task force commander, was present to confer with his troops, to issue last-minute instructions, to review the final plans, and to give the word to go or to cancel as necessary. The Murkison involvement in the assassination as one of the vast oil empires in the United States may be the explanation for the hiding of Sylvia Odio. 1. A young Cuban refugee and a very important... Oh, that's a footnote, excuse me. A young Cuban refugee and a very important witness. Right after the assassination, Mrs. Odio was hidden in the home of Jack Rogers of Dallas, whose father, Ralph Rogers, is president of Texas Industries, one of the many firms controlled by the Murkison people. Mrs. Odio stated in the Warren Commission hearings that a man resembling Oswald and called Leon Oswald by his friends had visited her apartment. She recognized Lee Harvey Oswald when his picture was shown on TV as being the man who had been to her apartment. Friends of hers had reported to Mrs. Odio that this Leon Oswald had made statements that President Kennedy should have been killed after the Bay of Pigs. This Leon Oswald also stated that the president could be killed easily. After the decision was made that Oswald acted alone, Mrs. Odio's statements were unwelcome. Admittedly, our information about Hoover's presence was learned secondhand, but it is reliable. So basically, it's, as Penn indicated, not conclusive, but certainly for the overthrow of the U.S. government, there has to have been a conference someplace in the vicinity before it was to happen. And with Richard Nixon and J. Edgar Hoover being present in the home of Clint Murchison Jr. the night before, it's an interesting possibility. It's certainly a very strong possibility that that is what they were doing there, and that may have been where Henry Cabot Lodge was calling.
Indeed, and one of the things that we've seen has been a very strong overlap of contact between various right-wing groups, many of them keyed into this same Texas right-wing crypto-fascist billionaire milieu, if I can cobble a kind of extreme phrase. Contacts between those groups and military and quasi-military groups. We talked about Hunt and the Hunt family and the AVG groups and others. But one of the things that's significant is because of the fact that, as revealed in several books about the Kennedy assassination, we'll be talking about some of those tonight, that so many things quickly went into the hands of the military, as they do during times of crises immediately after the Kennedy assassination, and that there was a great deal of control over the information and the kinds of things that were done and the information disseminated, and that control emanated almost completely from various military sources, as they often do during times of great worry, stress, and national danger. Anyway, going to read a small bit here from a book called A Heritage of Stone. The book is by Jim Garrison, who is, of course, the New Orleans district attorney, who is the only man who has really tried to put together a conspiracy case from a legal standpoint in the Kennedy assassination and tried to prosecute it through to its ultimate end, although he was stymied to an extent, although not the extent that it is known, that is thought in popular mind. But anyway, the book is A Heritage of Stone, describing his travails, by Jim Garrison. And the book was published in 1970 by G.P. Putnam Sons, New York. And what we're talking about here is the autopsy, and I will clarify any details after I read from this segment from Heritage of Stone. Immediately following the assassination, doctors at Parkland Hospital had... Parkland Hospital, by the way, is in Dallas. At Parkland Hospital had diagnosed the president's neck wound as an anterior wound received in the front of the neck. The long-concealed Zapruder film shows the president distinctly reacting as if the neck wound were received in the front. Yet the world had been told that there was only one assassin, and that he was in the book depository to the president's rear. A probe of the neck wound by the pathologists in the Bethesda autopsy room would have revealed which way the truth lay. In retrospect, it is easy to see that this is precisely why no such probe was allowed. The neck wound, with the indications of a bullet entry but no exit, was to be the last real hurdle for the planners of the assassination. Afterward, the federal government would seize control of the investigation, despite its complete lack of legal authority, and that would be, in more ways than one, the end of the matter. It was 5 years after the assassination at the trial in New Orleans that it was learned that the neck wound had never been examined. Colonel Pierre Fink, F-I-N-C-K, the Army pathologist subpoenaed from Washington by the District Attorney's Office, had an unusually retentive memory for details. He simply could not recall, however, who ordered the pathologists not to look at the wound in the neck. Considering the historic occasion, and considering the implications of such a strange order, one would think he would never forget the man who issued this command. Fink was able to remember that the man was a general and that he was not a doctor. But then his memory failed him. Fink was one of the pathologists who had conducted the autopsy. One of the other pathologists, Commander Humes, afterwards had burned his autopsy notes, contrary to medical custom. The government's pathologist was pressed on this point by the New Orleans District Attorney's Office. His questioning was conducted in behalf of the District Attorney's Office by Alvin Oser, O-S-E-R, the Executive Assistant District Attorney. Oser: well, at that particular time, doctor, why didn't you call the doctors at Parkland or attempt to ascertain what the doctors at Parkland may have done or may have seen while the president's body was still exposed to view on the autopsy table? Cutting in briefly to explain, what the the assistant district attorney is questioning him about is Fink was present at the autopsy at Bethesda. He's talking about what the doctors who tried to save Kennedy's life might have seen in Parkland in Dallas, and why several hours later, while they still have Kennedy's body on the autopsy table in Bethesda, they didn't call to compare notes with the Parkland doctors. Dr. Fink: I will remind you that I was not in charge of this autopsy, that I was called Ozer. You were a co-author of the report, though, weren't you, Doctor? Dr. Fink, wait. I was called as a consultant to look at these wounds. That doesn't mean I am running the show. Ozer, was Dr. Humes running the show? Dr. Fink, well, I heard Dr. Humes stating that... He said, who is in charge here? And I heard an army general, I don't remember his name, stating, I am. You must understand that in those circumstances, there were law enforcement officers, military people with various ranks, and you have to coordinate the operation according to directions. Ozer, but you were one of the three qualified pathologists standing at that autopsy table, were you not, Doctor? Dr. Fink, yes, I was. Ozer, was this Army General a qualified pathologist? Fink, no. Ozer, was he a doctor? Fink, no, not to my knowledge. Ozer, can you give me his name, Colonel? Dr. Fink, no, I can't. I don't remember. Ozer, do you happen to have the photographs and x-rays taken of President Kennedy's body at the time of the autopsy and shortly thereafter? Do you? Dr. Fink, I do not have x-rays or photographs of President Kennedy with me. Ozer, how many other military personnel were present at the autopsy, in the autopsy room? Fink, that autopsy room was quite crowded. It is a small autopsy room, and when you are called in circumstances like that to look at the wound of the President of the United States who is dead, you don't look around too much to ask people for their names and take notes on who they are and how many there are. I did not do so. The room was crowded with military and civilian personnel and federal agents, Secret Service agents, FBI agents, for part of the autopsy, but I cannot give you a precise breakdown as regards the attendance of the people in that autopsy room at Bethesda Naval Hospital. Ozer, Colonel, did you feel that you had to take orders from this Army general that was there directing the autopsy? Dr. Fink, no, because there were others. There were admirals. Ozer, there were admirals? Fink, oh yes, there were admirals, and when you were a lieutenant colonel in the Army, you just follow orders. And at the end of the autopsy, we were specifically told, as I recall it, it was by Admiral Kinney, the Surgeon General of the Navy. This is subject to verification. We were specifically told not to discuss this case. Now Ozer began to press the Army pathologist. Observe Dr. Fink's rapid backpedaling in this sensitive area, writes Jim Garrison. Ozer, did you have any occasion? Do you have an occasion to dissect the track of that particular bullet in the victim as it lay in the autopsy table? Dr. Fink, I did not dissect the track in the neck. Ozer, why? Fink, this leads us into the disclosure of medical records. Ozer, Your Honor, I would like an answer from the colonel, and I would ask the court to so direct. The court, that is correct. You should answer, Doctor. Fink, we didn't remove the organs at the neck. Ozer, why not, Doctor? Fink, for the reason that we were told to examine the head wounds, and that the... Ozer, are you saying someone told you not to dissect the track? The court, let him finish his answer. Fink, I was told that the family wanted an examination of the head, as I recall, the head and chest, but the prosecutors in this autopsy didn't remove the organs of the neck, to my recollection. Ozer, you have said they did not. I want to know why didn't you, as an autopsy pathologist, attempt to ascertain the track through the body which you had on the autopsy table in trying to ascertain the cause or causes of death? Why? Fink, I had the cause of death. Ozer, why did you not trace the track of the wound? Fink, as I recall, I didn't remove these organs from the neck. Ozer, I didn't hear you. Fink, I examined the wounds, but I didn't remove the organs of the neck. Ozer, you said you didn't do this. I am asking you why you didn't do this as a pathologist. Fink, from what I recall, I looked at the trachea. There was a tracheotomy wound, the best I can remember, but I didn't dissect or remove these organs. Ozer, Your Honor, I would ask Your Honor to direct the witness to answer my question. I will ask you the question one more time. Why did you not dissect the track of the bullet wound that you have described today and you saw at the time of the autopsy, at the time you examined the body? Why? I ask you to answer that question. Fink, as I recall, I was told not to, but I don't remember by whom. Ozer, you were told not to, but you don't remember by whom? Think. Right. Ozer, could it have been one of the admirals or one of the generals in the room? Think. I don't recall. Ozer, do you have any particular reason why you cannot recall at this time? Think. Because we were told to examine the head and the chest cavity, and that doesn't include the removal of the organs of the neck. Ozer, you are one of the three autopsy specialists and pathologists at the time, and you saw what you described as an entrance wound in the neck area of the President of the United States, who had just been assassinated, and you were only interested in the other wound, but not interested in the track through his neck. Is that what you're telling me? Dr. Fink, I was interested in the track, and I had observed the conditions of bruising between the point of entry in the back of the neck and the point of exit at the front of the neck, which is entirely compatible with the bullet path. Ozer, but you were told not to go into the area of the neck. Is that your testimony? Dr. Fink, from what I recall, yes, but I don't remember by whom.
Okay, now, basically, what we're just looking at there is the military, again, affecting a key degree of control over the autopsy results with regard to the assassination of President Kennedy, again, an overthrow of the legitimate government of the United States. This essentially puts us right back in the same framework that we were in at the end of the last broadcast. Now, what we'd like to do is to pick up and develop a theme that we were developing at that time, namely looking at the John Birch Society as an analog to the German Nazi Party, a vehicle for introducing the military into civilian political society in order to effect a change, a drastic change to the right. Now, one of the things to remember about the John Birch Society is that it is not only extremely powerful, but it is really much more powerful than the power wielded by its card-carrying members. The John Birch Society is much, much more significant than one would guess by looking at just the people who are members, although the members themselves are powerful enough. One of the most important things about the JBS is the large number of very impressive names that they are able to gather for their various committees and organizations, not necessarily card-carrying members of the John Birch Society, but luminaries of the right and far right that they are able to muster in various organizations. Now, I'm going to read some names here from an organization called the Committee to Preserve the Monroe Doctrine. Now, this is from the John Birch Society's White Book of 1963. There's no publisher. It's put out by the John Birch Society and copyright 1963 by the John Birch Society. The White Book, by the way, is sort of a compilation of all of their material issued for the year 63. And here there's a list of 68 names from the Committee to Preserve the Monroe Doctrine. And I'm going to go down the list in a rough alphabetical order and identify some of the key people. Now, remember, not all of these people are card-carrying members of the John Birch Society. In fact, some of them at times have gone on record as ridiculing such JBSers as Robert Welch, its founder, who called Eisenhower a communist and so forth. Remember that this organization is extremely powerful, much more powerful than its membership, its nominal membership, would indicate. And this organization here, the Committee to Preserve the Monroe Doctrine, is a good example. In the B's, we find remember, this is 1963 now. We find Mr. William F. Buckley, Jr. Of course, William F. Buckley is a columnist, editor of the National Review, former CIA operative, key operative in Japan and Mexico, and also a member of the exclusive Vatican Military Order, the Sovereign Military Order of Malta. And for a long time, Buckley has been one of the luminaries of the far right. By the way, this organization is specifically, Committee to Preserve the Monroe Doctrine was specifically exercised about Cuba and Castro. And Cuba and Castro is going to be front and center in the broadcast tonight. Going down the D's, we find Professor Lev E. Dobriansky. Now, Lev Dobriansky is someone we're going to come across in our next, the concluding section of our Aryan Nations Radio Free America series. Dobriansky is head of an organization called he's very closely affiliated with it. He's not actually the head of an organization called the League of Anti-Bolshevik Nations, or the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations. And that basically is an organization which is one of the primary elements of the World Anti-Communist League. And we've talked about that in the past. We're going to talk about it in the future. And before I continue with this list of names right now, Nip Tuck is going to read you about an individual named Spaz Rakin and how he figures into the assassination of President Kennedy. This is a piece of information, by the way, that is in our Guns of November number 4. We're going to review it here by way of shoring up this by way of indicating the milieu that Lev Dobryansky associates with, and again, we're going to come back to him in our fourth, in the fourth part of our broadcast when we talk about the World Anti-Communist League at greater length. And remember that Dobryansky is Reagan's ambassador to the Bahamas.
Okay, and just want to mention that broadcasting from Foothill College, this is KFJC, Los Altos Hills. I'm going to read a short segment here from a book entitled The Assassinations, Dallas and Beyond. It's edited by Peter Dale Scott, Paul L. Hoch, H-O-C-H, and Russell Stettler, S-T-E-T-L-E-R. Copyright 1976, Vintage Books, a division of Random House, an excellent anthology for anybody, especially people first approaching the Kennedy assassination and others, because it gives a very even-handed approach to things. It allows people who actually worked for the Warren Commission to give their version of events, and believe me, they damn themselves by their own words more than when they're not allowed to speak. And it's a very, very good opportunity for people to hear both sides.
By the way, the essay Nip is going to read from here is called From Dallas to Watergate by one of the editors, Peter Dale Scott.
Okay. Quoting Scott, the desire of U.S. intelligence agencies to interview even casual visitors to the Soviet Union is well known. In June 1962, Lee Harvey Oswald was a returning Marine defector who had once served at a CIA base and had told the U.S. Embassy in Moscow of his intention to pass information to Soviet officials. For 2 years, he had worked in a sensitive Soviet factory and was now married to the niece of a colonel in Soviet intelligence. Yet, the report tells us that the returning Oswalds were met in New York City not by the FBI or CIA, but by, quote, Spaz T. Rakin, a representative of the Travelers Aid Society. The FBI interviews did not point out that Spaz T. Rakin, R-A-I-K-I-N, first name spelled S-P-A-S, was also the Secretary General of the American Friends of the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, a small but vigorous group of right-wing, revanchist East Europeans in direct touch with the FBI and Army Intelligence, and also with the Galen Spy Organization in West Germany, the Kuomintang in Taiwan, the mother of Madame Nu, right-wing Cubans like Oswald's DRE contact Carlos Bringier, and other elements of a shadowy, quote, World Anti-Communist League. This WACL, World Anti-Communist League, had contacts with U.S. anti-communists in New Orleans, in the building with a Camp Street address used by Oswald on his pro-Castro literature, and also by the CIA's Cuban Revolutionary Council, of which Bringier had once been press secretary. As I have indicated in my book, The War Conspiracy, Mr. Rakin's personal correspondents in Taiwan, the Asian People's Anti-Communist League, were intelligence agents involved in the Kuomintang's narcotics traffic, a fact dramatically illustrated by the 1971 arrest in Paris of the chief Laotian delegate to the APACL, the Asian People's Anti-Communist League, whose suitcase containing 60 kilos of high-grade heroin would have been worth $13.5 million on the streets of New York. Okay, just to point out again, the FBI, the CIA, nobody met from the government, met and debriefed or in any way dealt with or threatened litigation or criminal penalties against this defector who had gone from a top secret air base at Atsugi in Japan and had said he was going to give away secrets of the American missile system and spy systems to the Soviets, and he comes back and the only guy who meets him is a guy from the World Anti-Communist League, Spaz T. Rakin.
Worth noting also the links of the World Anti-Communist League to the Kuomintang that we spoke about in our last broadcast, and to a number of different elements that we're going to be talking about a little later.
And again, just because people are at all different levels of understanding of history that listen to these broadcasts, again, the Kuomintang, spelled K-U-O-M-I-N-T-A-N-G, is the government of Chiang Kai-shek, the quote-unquote nationalist government of China, which was in fact fiercely anti-communist and in mortal struggle with its internal communists in China, all before and during World War II, and fell 4 years after World War II to the communists. So when we refer to the Kuomintang, we're talking about Chiang Kai-shek's right-wing government of China.
Okay, so we're going to be coming back to the World Anti-Communist League and its connections to 544 Camp Street, and the the CRC, the Cuban Revolutionary Council, Carlos Bringer, and so forth later in the broadcast. For the time being, though, just note Lev Dobryansky's presence on this list in 1963. Remember his connections to the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, a key element of the World Anti-Communist League, and remember also that he's Reagan's ambassador to the Bahamas. This will be coming back to not only later in the broadcast, but in next week's program as well. Moving down through the list in the F section, there's an interesting name, General Bonner Fellers. Now, Bonner Fellers was a key MacArthur staffer, a John Birch Society member, and we looked at him in our last broadcast as well. Moving through the Fs, there is listed here, Mr. Patrick Frawley, Jr., F-R-A-W-L-E-Y. Now, Patrick Frawley is a far right-wing financier and ideologue, a key member of Ronald Reagan's kitchen cabinet, and he's, for our purposes here, most importantly, head of an organization or one of the key operatives in an organization called the American Security Council. And we're going to talk about Pat Frawley and the American Security Council later.
And those of you who are regular listeners will remember last time that we were talking about Ronald Reagan, the President of the United States, being interviewed on Ted Koppel's Nightline program and making a remark about why he did not trust the Soviet Union, talking about a quote ascribed to Lenin about the Soviets' plan for world domination and America falling at last like an overripe fruit into the hands of the Soviets, etc., etc. And the writer of this particular article went after this quote, said, where did Reagan get this quote? Eventually tracked it down and found, in fact, that there was no basis for that ever having been said by Lenin. It was nowhere in his collected works, his collected speeches, and that, in fact, the source for it, for a statement that our president used as a reason and justification for his Soviet policy, that, in fact, it was from a John Birch Society propaganda handout. And that's just to let you know. Patrick Frawley, of course, very much involved with these kinds of John Birch Society propaganda handouts. And Patrick Frawley, one of the people who got Ronald Reagan his start in politics, and obviously the kind of person who is still an influence on our president to this very moment.
Remember the name. We'll be coming back to him in a big way later in the broadcast. Now, moving down through the list, we find in the H section here a name that will ring a bell for people that have heard or either heard our broadcast, our Radio Free America program about the assassination of Martin Luther King, or for people who are familiar with the course of that case. In the H section, we find Mayor Arthur J. Haynes, last name H-A-N-E-S. Now, recall that Arthur Haynes is not only a former U.S. intelligence agent. He, by the way, mayor refers to the fact that he's the mayor, or was, the mayor of Birmingham, Alabama. He was the mayor of Birmingham, Alabama during a key period in the early 60s, during not only the time during which Birmingham was the focal point of much of the civil rights struggle, in which Bull Connor and a number of reactionary elements received a lot of publicity in their brutal attempted suppression of the civil rights workers who had converged on Birmingham during the Freedom Summer and so forth. Mayor Arthur Haynes was mayor of Birmingham during that key period. Also, he was mayor of Birmingham when Birmingham was was involved with the training for the Bay of Pigs invasion. Now, recall in our Guns of November broadcast number one, we talked about the Bay of Pigs and specifically how a bunch of propeller-driven B-26 bombers used by the anti-Castro Cubans there were shot down by Castro's Air Force, and a subterfuge was involved there. Actually, the whole operation was subverted from within, but we saw how the pilots who were training to fly these propeller-driven B-26s were training in Birmingham, Alabama, because the Birmingham Air National Guard was one of the last organizations to fly the B-26. So as a result, they were the most experienced group of B-26 pilots in the area. Now,